ShareCare, helping you find experts, the top minds in health and medicine. It's ShareCare Radio with Dr. Daria Long Gillespie on RadioMD.com.
Welcome back. It's Dr. Daria. And for this segment, we're jumping into our Ask Dr. Daria segment where I answer real users' questions on all things health and wellness. So our first one, this segment and this episode today seems to be a lot on babies. And this one was from likely a mom or dad or other child caregiver saying, how can I get my baby to go to sleep? This is the million-dollar question any parent knows, and they would pay their left arm probably to be able to answer how to get their children to sleep. And if your baby does go to sleep and you're one of those lucky parents, just don't tell anybody. So for everybody else, there's many, many ways, and every parent has to find what's best for them and their child. It's such a common problem. 45% of mothers say they have problems with sleep with their 6 to 12 month olds. And those others who didn't say they did probably had a problem with their child either before they were 6 months or after, because we know that every kid goes in phases and they have difficult times and not. There's a couple of things you can do. You've probably heard of different forms of sleep training, and we'll get into that. But most important for whatever you decide to do, number one is keeping a consistent routine. Do the same thing every night. You know, in our own home, that means after dinner, she comes upstairs, gets a bath. We do a cup of milk that's usually a little bit warmed. We do books, and then we go to bed. And it's always that same routine so that the child starts to know when they get the bath, they know that the milk and the books are coming in bed after that. And it really helps them, you know, get into that routine and get ready for bed. Much like for an adult, having a bath before bed and really resets your body to get ready to relax and sleep. So one is keeping a consistent routine. Number two is once your baby's above a certain age and your doctor and pediatrician has said that they're able to sleep through the night, you know, you don't have to run in the instant the baby makes a noise. Many times my child will have a little bit of a holler, scream a little bit for a second, just enough to wake me up, often get me to jump out of bed because I think something's wrong, and then she goes back to sleep and doesn't wake up at all. So pay attention. Your child may just wake up for a second, just kind of startle, and then go back to sleep themselves. And if you immediately go in, as soon as they make that quick startle, you don't give them the opportunity to fall back asleep. So I'm not saying you have to let them cry for a long period of time, but I'm just saying sometimes after about 30 seconds or 15 seconds or even less than that, they may go back to sleep on their own and you don't need to disturb them. You know, number three, is it around 1 month of age, if you've gotten the approval from your pediatrician, if your child is kind of drowsy, they're happy, they're no longer hungry, their diaper is clean, it's a good chance to try to let them start to fall asleep on their own. Give them a chance. A lot of children, if that happens and they're already comfortable, will fall asleep on their own and they're not going to need a lot of help. Others, it won't be that easy, but it's always good to try. Then there are multiple schools of how to actually get your child to sleep train. There's the more of the attachment parenting that goes to sleep with the child in their own bed. There is the exact opposite of crying it out. And then there's some hybrids in the middle. And the reality is, one study looked at parents with children 7 months old in either a cry it out or not at all cry it out, let the child fall asleep in your arms. And those that let cry it out and those that let babies really just stay in their arms until they're asleep. They found that both sets of parents using either technique had better outcomes in their child's sleep at 10 months than parents who didn't use any technique at all and just didn't stay consistent. So what this study found was that as long as you are consistent, either doing one way or the other, you have the best chances of success. So that's really important, is just to find what you're most comfortable with and then follow that for your child, and you're going to have the best chance of getting them to sleep and you to get your own rest too, because as a parent, you're sleep deprived and it's very important to do and get your own rest. Now, our next question is about skin cancer. We just had another segment about heat, and I was talking earlier about the increasing rise of melanoma. So there are this user had said, what are the symptoms of skin cancer? Now, there are two kinds of skin cancer. There's melanoma that can occur anywhere on the body, including places you don't always see easily, such as the inside of the nose or the mouth. And there's non-melanoma, and that can occur anywhere as well, but often on sun-exposed areas like the head, the face, neck, back of the arms and legs. Now, melanoma symptoms may look like a birthmark or a mole, but it has a few distinguishing features. And these are the ABCDEs you may have heard. So A, asymmetry. Now, is one half of it different from the other versus if it's a perfect circle? If it's not a perfect circle and it is asymmetric, that's a little bit of a warning sign. Border, is the border uneven or jagged? Color, is there more than one color to it? diameter? Is it larger than the diameter of the eraser of the end of the pencil? And evolution, is it changing over time? Did you look and notice that it's larger, its shape is different, its color is different? All of these are sort of red flags. And if you notice that, then it's a sign that you really should get into your doctor to have it checked. Now, non-melanoma types of skin cancer, the symptoms could be pink, red or swollen, peeling, may even be bleeding or look like an open sore or be thick or crusty. Bottom line is, you know, we mentioned evolution for melanoma, and that's really the bottom line, is if you see any skin changes that you really can't explain, always a good idea to get in to see your doctor to evaluate it and see what's going on. You can always start out with your primary care doctor and then go to a dermatologist, and they'll help guide you for that. Now, our next one said, are all calories the same? And the answer is simple. It's yes and no. But really, for everybody, it's really, it depends on what we're talking about and the purpose. It's really not that simple. For weight gain, yes, a calorie is a calorie. They can all be converted to fat. And the amount you take in, if that's greater than the amount you burn, that will be converted to fat. But it's also what that calorie is associated with that determines if it's something that your body needs, or something that will help you with your health and weight loss, or if it's just a plain empty calorie. You know, even for weight loss, what's actually associated with that calorie makes a difference. So is it accompanied by good fats, lots of lean protein or fiber, or is that calorie just accompanied by a lot of sugars, as in a soda? So if you're trying to lose weight, having food and calories that are accompanied by a lot of fiber can really help you up, keep you full longer, with less calorie intake, and that's really what you want to do. Lots of other calories associated with high sugars, in which case that's just empty. So it's paying attention to your calories, making sure that what you take in is less than what you burn, and the way you can do that on less calories is by paying attention to what's with them, such as fiber, to help fill you up. Now, our next question was about, what are some benefits to changing up my exercise routine? There's a number of different benefits to getting some variety, and for one is less likelihood of injury from repetitive stress. And if you're just running every day or just spinning or whatever it is, if you're doing the exact same thing every day, you're going to put yourself at higher likelihood of injury. It's also more fun to mix it up. If you do one activity today and something different tomorrow, it just makes it more interesting, more fun, more engaging. It can strengthen different muscles if you're doing different activities, kind of a cross-training of effect. And studies have shown that people that do a combination of cardio and weights have better outcomes for that weight and other benefits of exercise. Besides, the more you do, the more it's likely that you'll find those activities that you really love and that you will stick with. So I'm a big advocate of mixing it up. Whatever increases your chances that you will stick with it is the most important. Now, our next listener had said, what is the difference between vaccination and immunization? Now, this can be confusing. In most of the ways we discuss them, they're the same thing, but there is a slight nuance. So immunization refers to the building of immunity to a certain infectious disease, such as chickenpox, the flu, or polio. And that can be built two ways. The first way you can build immunity is just by getting the illness in the first place. For instance, if you catch in the chickenpox, it will make you sick, but after you recover, you'll likely be immune to it. The second way is by receiving a small amount of that disease, often in an inactivated form, and your body gets exposed to it, but it's not enough to make you sick. So your body is exposed to it, you can build antibodies to it, and you now have an immunity. Both of those result in the likelihood that you won't get sick from that a second time if you've already been sick in the first place. In both ways, because it's exposed to the illness, which we call the antigen, and makes immune cells against that disease. So your body can fight it off if you're ever exposed to it again. The beauty of the vaccine is that you can build that immunity without getting sick in the first place. Now, lastly, one of our listeners had asked about what I can do to reduce bloating. And we'll talk about this a little bit next week. But for one, look at what you're eating. It may make it more like, look, if you see you eat a certain food one day and it makes you feel bloated that afternoon, pay attention. That's the number one step I want you to take. Start there, and then we will talk more about it on our segment next week. And that's all the time we have for today. We'll be back next week on Share Care Radio to answer more of your questions from Ask Dr. Daria. Stay with us for our next segment. This is Dr. Daria, and you're listening to Share Care Radio on Radio MD. Thanks for listening, and stay well.